From NPR and The Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Coming up in the next half hour, Precious Knowledge is a new documentary on the now-banned Mexican-American Ethnic Studies program in Tucson, Arizona.
For him to say that these teachers were teaching us hate was absolutely ridiculous.
We visit Havana, Cuba, and hear about the lives of two lesbians living under the pressures that came with the revolution.
If you even look gay, they would arrest you.
And we visit the tough streets of San Francisco's Tenderloin District, where a small green haven grows.
It was just asphalt and a lot of garbage.
And 25-year-old jockey Mario Gutierrez wins the Kentucky Derby.
I'll have another! I've won the Kentucky Derby!
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. This week, we pull back and get an overview of some of the latest developments in the Latino political world. Joining us today is Angelo Falcón. He's the president of the National Institute of Latino Policy and a frequent guest here on Latino USA. Welcome back to Latino USA, Angelo.
Nice to be back.
All right. So a little bit of tiny, incy-beansy steps or movement buzz around immigration reform, peering its head back into this conversation. Why? And what's being said?
Well, right now, the problem we have is a lot of promises and no action on the part of the Obama administration. He's certainly getting a lot of pressure from the Latino community. So he's trying to be as creative as he can with his ability as through executive orders and his obviously influence over ICE and Homeland Securities to lighten things up a little bit. But he's still pursuing his deportation policies, although he's trying to make some exceptions. On the right, in terms of the Republican Party, there's a buzz around Rubio and the possibility that they may come up with some sort of Dream Act light or process of dream acting. What he said so far is he's talking about a proposal that will allow young people who are here undocumented without papers to be able to go to school. But once they complete, they could get a visa to stay in the country and then have the opportunity to then apply for citizenship. The hurdles that these people have put into this thing are ridiculous. I personally think is unworkable for young people.
So why do they say it's Dream Act Lite? Because there is no guarantee to citizenship?
Well, there is no path to citizenship built into it. That's the big difference, and that's the big issue.
So it really isn't a Dream Act.
It's some people call it a Nightmare Act. So it's really not a solution. And one of the problems with the Dream Act discussion is that it's possible that if they pass something like this, it may mean the end of any hope for any kind of comprehensive immigration reform. And while this is important, it's still also only a small piece of the entire issue. And that's one of the things that we haven't been discussing. Some people see the Dream Act as a down payment kind of thing towards a larger kind of comprehensive reform. But I don't know. And the politics this year, it's impossible during this election period to see anything happening in this area.
Talking about the Latino community and numbers for a second. Numbers, of course, 43% demographic growth in the last decade, according to the census. The other numbers that have stayed the same, though, are the amount of dollars that Latino nonprofits are getting from philanthropy.
Sure.
And right now, a recent report out from Hispanics in Philanthropy, they basically found that it's about one penny of every philanthropic dollar ends up going towards a Latino-run or a Latino-directed nonprofit grassroots organization.
In December, the Foundation Center, with funding from Hispanics and Philanthropy, issued a report, and they found that in the last 10 years, the percentage of monies going to Latino community from foundations has stayed at around 1%. Now, the community, as you mentioned at the beginning, has been growing like leaps and bounds, and meanwhile, there's been no change. And what's really bugged me about the whole process was when they put out the press release from the Foundation Center and even Hispanics and Philanthropy, the headline was, "Foundation support for Latinos remains steady." No, we're getting screwed. So what's happening is that this 1% figure has been around longer. I mean, the 10 years is the period that the report covered, but it's been a longer-term issue. And I don't see the outrage in the community. I don't see the mobilization in the community. One of the groups that's trying to raise the issue is Hispanics and Philanthropy, but they're an insider group. You know, they're part of the foundation sector. We need to get other actors in the Latino community to step up, start raising this issue, and start raising hell with these foundations and hold them accountable. One of the things that's interesting about foundation money is it can't replace government monies, but it's money that's important for, I think, advocacy. It's money that allows groups to have the freedom to be advocates. And one of the things that we've come weak in many areas, especially at the national level, is around the area of advocacy. So I think it's an issue that we need to galvanize the nonprofit community, we need, in the Latino community, the faith-based community, the different sectors, and really take on these foundations. Well, some people are talking about legislation at the state level, like they tried to do in California a couple of years ago, to put the pressure on these guys. And I think that's, you know, the situation's gotten so bad that I think that's what might happen.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and bringing us up to date on those issues. Angelo Falcón.
My pleasure.
Angelo Falcón is the president of the National Institute for Latino Policy. He spoke to us from our studios at the NPR Bureau in New York. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org, or you can follow us on Twitter. We are Latino USA, all one word. And we're back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. So stay with us. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In Tucson, Arizona, where Latino children make up a little more than half the student population, educators began a Mexican-American studies program at a local high school. Graduation rates rose. So did the number of students that went on to college. The program became a model of success. But last year, it was eliminated by the Tucson School Board. The fate of that program is the subject of a new documentary airing on PBS. Precious Knowledge airs on the program Independent Lens. Erin Isabel McGinnis is co-director of the film. She joins us now with Alana Castro, one of the students who took part in the high school program and who's featured in the film. They join us from station KUAZ in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you for having us on your show.
So, Erin, you and your partner, Ari Luis Palos, when did you realize that you had a great story to tell?
Precious Knowledge is about Tucson High School and students and teachers and their efforts to save their beloved Mexican-American studies classes. These Mexican-American studies classes were sort of famous for being innovative and also for helping keep kids in high school and going on to college. They had a 93% on average graduation rate for their students. And so what happened is the state government decided to shut this program down, and it took 3 years, but eventually they were successful.
So before we speak to Alana, who's a student, give us a sense of that pedagogy. Who basically started the La Raza Studies program and why?
Well, it was a group of educators at the high school level and also at the University of Arizona who created this amazing curriculum. It's called a critically compassionate curriculum, and it gets the students to appreciate their history and culture. They feel like if you can get a young person to know about their own history and culture, then they have a much better chance of getting through high school.
So, Alana, you actually, of course, you studied this. You were a student. The film makes it seem like the kids are really into it. There's that one moment where the mom is like, you know what? Now my son or daughter, I don't remember which one is, all they want to do is study.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, because of this program, what makes you become a better student?
Well, because what you're actually learning pertains to you and it becomes interesting to you. You see yourself in these situations and in the character's shoes or, you know, this person's shoes, and you realize, hey, I'm not alone out there. There's other people like me. And you have a classroom full of people who are understanding the same thing as well.
So at some point, the state superintendent of public schools, Tom Horn, begins to express basically his uneasiness with the program. And he believed that basically it was dividing the students by ethnicity. He said that it appealed to the primitive tribal part of humans. Very, very harsh criticism about La Raza Studies program. Do you think that any part of his critique is valid?
We don't learn about race. We learn about, the human race. Like, we are all human. For him to say that these teachers were teaching us hate and all this other, you know, crazy stuff was absolutely ridiculous. And it's really hard to understand when you're 16, 17 years old. Like, Why doesn't he come in here? Like, why doesn't he see what I'm learning?
So one thing that's happened is that as opposition at the state level has grown, the students become more militant, more engaged, more involved, frankly. Some of them get arrested, but they're clearly engaged with a political reality in their state. What do you think about that aspect of what's happened?
Well, I think that we have to always analyze why the students were engaged. The students were engaged because they were trying to save their classes. I think when people start throwing words around like militant, it's very interesting. When youth of color want to do something, they're always described as militant. But the reason they were militant is because they were trying to save their classes.
So, Alana, what have you been doing since you graduated from high school?
I am currently attending Pima Community College. This is kind of ironic. I work for TUSD, the Tucson Unified School District.
It is ironic. What do you do for TUSD?
I am a monitor at an elementary school, and I also work at the after-school program. So it's a completely different entity, as you know, as far as what's going on with the Mexican-American studies. And my ultimate dream is to have my own nonprofit where I can help young people to pay their rent or whatever it is they want to do, as long as they keep going to school and furthering their education.
Well, thanks very much for joining us on Latino USA to both of you.
Thank you, Maria.
Erin Isabel McGinnis is one of the filmmakers who made Precious Knowledge. Alana Castro is one of the students featured in the film. Precious Knowledge airs May 17th on Independent Lens on PBS stations around the country. Check your local listings for more information. And now to Cuba. After the 1959 revolution, official policy in Cuba named homosexuality counter-revolutionary. But the situation for gays and lesbians in current-day Cuba has changed significantly. There's now an officially sanctioned 2-week series of events around gay and lesbian life, with panels, parades, drag shows, and other cultural events. It's called La Jornada Contra la Homofobia, and it began this year on May 10th. Reporter Vaughn Diaz spent some time speaking with lesbians who lived those years on the island after the revolution and has their story.
I met Gloria in her apartment. Her living room is painted avocado green, the kitchen orange, the bedroom rust. She and her partner have lived there together just under a year. Gloria came out to her parents when she was 16. It was 1966, just 7 years after the Cuban Revolution.
Vino mi primera relación y...
Then I had my first lesbian relationship, and I wanted to be upfront and decided to bring her home. I wanted to be a good person and explain it to my father, who I loved and I still love deeply. And I wanted to explain it to him. I said, yes, I like women, but I promise you I will behave. I'm going to get an education, and this doesn't mean anything. And it seemed like he understood, but his reaction was intense. And that reaction was that he locked me in my room for a year. And they wouldn't let me out. Then they took me to a psychiatrist to change the way I was because they thought I was sick.
Soon after her parents began letting her out of the house again, Gloria got a job and met her first long-term girlfriend. But her parents and official policy forbade her from taking her relationship public. So she married a gay man to keep up appearances. That didn't go so well.
Porque yo tenía mi pareja y él tenía su pareja.
He had his partner and I had my partner, and we had to meet up at the same place every day. We would leave the house together every day, go meet our partners, go to the park, and go see friends and whatever, because his partner couldn't come home and mine couldn't either. Almost all of the gays and lesbians had to get married, because you had to. Society demanded it.
Life was complicated during that era in Cuba, and particularly for gays and lesbians. The police arrested people just because they looked gay. They also arrested people who hung out in La Rampa, a known gay and lesbian meeting spot. Some people were taken to jail, while others were taken to the UMOP forced labor camps.
Decir que en Cuba, que la sociedad cubana había homosexuales, era imposible.
To even say that they were gays in Cuba, in Cuban society, was impossible. Because if you were gay, you could not be a teacher. If you were gay, you could not be a member of the Communist Party. If you compare young lesbians now to those in my teenage years, I can tell you that now they don't have to hide anything. You see them on the beach and they can do things I could never do. I couldn't give my partner a kiss in public, even if I really, really wanted to, or hold her hand at the theater, or at the movies, or anything like that.
Getting housing as children grow and relationships change is difficult in Cuba. Gloria and her partner Anita are lucky they have a home of their own.
Ella todo lo encuentra bonito.
All she sees is the beauty in things. Everything around her is stars, some bright colors, some bubbles. And she showed me all of that. And she relieved some of the pain I felt.
Despite the obstacles she's faced, Gloria has a happy life. She's in a good relationship, and she and her partner attend annual gay pride events in Havana. Visibility is important for LGBT rights, but visibility can put you at risk. Gloria was able to protect herself by staying hidden, but other lesbians didn't have that same luxury and were openly targeted because of how they looked.
I lived repression on G Street, on 23rd Street, and at Copelia. I was always under attack because of the clothes I wore. And if you even look gay, they would arrest you. At the beach, the police would come, open the doors, and take everyone away just for being gay.
Rosa is una mujer fuerte, a term in Cuba used to describe what in the U.S. is usually called butch. She uses masculine gestures, sits like a man, and says she's only attracted to very feminine women. And Rosa is 48 years old. She says she's been this way since she was very young.
My grandmother would give me dolls, and I hated them, and I would steal my brother's toys. I had to play with boys instead of the girls because the girls' mothers wouldn't let me play with them. I was something strange. I was a thing.
Rosa's childhood was difficult. She grew up in Trinidad, Cuba, with an illiterate, alcoholic mother who beat her frequently. When Rosa was a teenager, her mother forced her to take a boyfriend to, as she said, undo her gay sickness, and for money. At 15, she began drinking alcohol and left home. She never finished high school. She says she had to sell herself in order to eat. But around this time, she also fell in love.
Y para mí fue el día más lindo del mundo.
That was the most wonderful day of my life. I will never forget it. The sun rose, and it was raining in Havana, and I was in a hotel with large windows, and I could see the whole city. I could see the malecón. And I said to myself, I want this.
Because of Rosa's outward appearance, she stands out. She's never been able to evade detection, never been able to hide in the same way other women have. And because she stands out, she's had to confront homophobia head on.
Hoy por hoy me respetan, pero ¿por qué me respetan?
Today, men respect me. But why do they respect me? Because I stood up for myself.
Rosa overcame many of the challenges of her youth, but she still struggles to make ends meet. Because she did not complete high school, she can't get a job. She told me that she sometimes has to steal. She lives in a small apartment with her mother, brother, and girlfriend. Things have changed dramatically for gays and lesbians in Cuba in the last 20 years. The Cuban Center for Sex Education is an official state agency that provides family planning and HIV/AIDS services, as well as a number of support groups for gays, lesbians, and transgender Cubans of all ages. President Raúl Castro's daughter, Mariela, heads this agency, which also provides gender reassignment surgery free of charge. And this summer, Wendy Iriepa, the first person to surgically change her gender in Cuba, became the first trans person to be legally married. But despite the recent changes in Cuba, many lesbians, like Gloria, say they still feel there is a double standard.
Men just have more freedom than women because we live in a patriarchal world.
Reporting from Havana, I'm Vaughn Diaz.
Vaughn Diaz comes to us from Feet in Two Worlds, a project that brings the work of immigrant journalists to public radio. And coming up on Latino USA, we take a visit to the Tenderloin District, a neighborhood transformed. That's coming up on Latino USA. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. Thank you.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Lori Lazor and Daryl Smith took a trash-filled inner-city alley, really not more than a dump, in the heart of one of San Francisco's toughest neighborhoods and transformed it into a green and lively park. The park has become a focal point for local residents, helping create a true community for this ravaged neighborhood. As part of our series, Radio Nature, Joaquin Palomino has the story of what's now called the Tenderloin National Forest.
I'm going to paint the walls. I'm going to finish the tray first. I got one more tray to finish.
I got to see the trays.
Okay. I'm standing in the Tenderloin National Forest. Over the years, a lush garden has sprung up in this humble alley. Gabby Miller used to volunteer here in high school. Now she's helping Chris Birch, the forest's artist in residence, with an upcoming show.
I'm going to use the garden for a dance performance by Jasmine Donaldson. So she's going to interpret Amir Baraka's Something in the Way of Things. So I'm thinking we'll clear this out. And it's
this alley's a unique spot in an otherwise rough urban neighborhood.
In every major city, there are these very densely populated areas that are harsh, hard, with very little open space. The Tenderloin has been one of those neighborhoods.
The Tenderloin, for me, hope and despair walking hand in hand.
That's Lori Lazor and Daryl Smith. The Tenderloin District of San Francisco, where this park is located, is one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. It also has one of the highest concentrations of crime and of children.
I guess I was mostly moved by all the families in the Tenderloin, the mostly Southeast Asian families that had a lot of children living in small quarters. And there was no safe place for kids at all. And there were so many children.
The Tenderloin is four times more crowded than the rest of San Francisco, but there's only one moderately sized park.
What is prominent in this neighborhood are alleyways, which are kind of sort of these derelict, dark spaces, generally just used for, storing garbage.
Daryl and Lori used to live right above one of these alleys.
Cohen Alley is very narrow.
It gets a couple of hours of direct sunlight per day. It's surrounded by multi-story housing. Some will describe them as tenements. I just say housing.
Cohen Alley was a blight on the neighborhood.
It was just asphalt and a lot of garbage.
Whether it was excrement, needles, or illicit dumping by contractors.
Daryl and Lori formed a neighborhood committee, and they drafted a plan to transform this dark corner of the city into an oasis. Getting the whole community involved was crucial.
We would make flyers in English, Vietnamese, Cambodian, Laotian, so four languages, and we'd put them around the neighborhood.
They cleaned up the alley and hosted neighborhood parties.
We would get donations of, like, giant cakes and ice cream to feed everybody. And we had clowns and poets and music.
Then it was time to start planting. That was 10 years ago. Now 9 tall trees crown this tiny alley. Daryl takes us on a tour.
So we're kind of in the center part of the garden. There is a circular fish pond here that is home to a dozen koi goldfish.
Wherever you look, there's artwork. Murals cover the apartment walls, and hand-blown lights dangle between the buildings. The trees, the art, and the parties have all drawn in the neighbors.
I live around the corner, and I hadn't known that it was here. And then I wandered down here and just saw how beautiful it was. And it creates a place for people just to stop and rest.
That's Daniel Hill, another Tenderloin resident who works in the garden regularly. He's sweeping the walkway, but to him it feels like he's doing something much bigger.
It's just being part of a community. I mean, it's just, you know, we all take care of each other in some way or another. I just really believe in that community effort.
People that live here say they've never had a view in the places they've lived before, and now they, like, live near a forest. That's awesome.
For Latino USA, I'm Joaquin Palomino in San Francisco.
On Saturday, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, 25-year-old Mexican jockey Mario Gutierrez rode the horse, I'll Have Another, to victory in the Kentucky Derby. The race carried a $2 million prize, and Mario Gutierrez was a surprise winner. He's on the line with us now. Felicidades, Mario.
Thank you.
So, Mario, what is your life like now?
Oh, my God, it's been so busy.
I'm going to go and show my first pitch at the Dodgers game tonight. It's been unbelievable.
You're throwing a pitch at the Dodgers game tonight?
Yeah.
But you ride horses. You throw baseballs too?
Well, I'm going to try tonight.
Mario, you have never ridden in a Kentucky Derby. So tell me one thing. When you got on that horse, I'll have another. Did you know that you were going to win, or were you completely surprised by what happened?
You know what? I don't know why they didn't give I'll Have Another the chance. He had proof that he deserved to be at the Kentucky Derby. I knew the competition was so strong, but I never have a doubt that my coach was going to give me everything he had to the end. Everybody believed in the horse, like trainer, owner. We prove a lot of people wrong.
Mario, you come from a working-class family in Veracruz, in Mexico. Your dad was a jockey, but you're pretty much a small-town kid riding horses. So how do you get from there to winning and making it big at the Derby?
Well, yeah, like when I was 8 years old, 9 years old, my dad is the only one who was supporting the family, and then he started riding horses. I wanted to be like that. I wanted to ride horses. I grew up at the farm. I'm so glad that I got to make some real good friends. They support me all my career, and thanks to them, I finally got to build my beautiful family a house, a place that we got to go home. Nobody ever is gonna go and tell my mom to get out of that place. When I think about it, it seems like a fairy tale.
I want to ask you one final question, Mario. What do you think, or what do you hope, that your winning of the Kentucky Derby, Mexican-born, raised in Veracruz, trained in Canada, what kind of a message do you hope that your win at the Kentucky Derby will send?
I want the people to see that no matter where you are, no matter where we came from, no matter where we raised, all what we need is a little bit of opportunity. Great things happen. Great things can happen. I get emotional when I think about it. I just want everybody to never lose hope, never lose hope. And, you know, like, if it happens to me, I don't see the reason why it won't happen to anybody else in the future.
Mario, thank you so much for speaking to us. Congratulations. Felicidades.
Thank you, guys.
Mario Gutierrez won his very first Kentucky Derby as the jockey of I'll Have Another. He spoke to us from the Santa Anita Racetrack in Arcadia, California. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you've got any comments or suggestions about our program, please call our listener line, 646-571-1228, 646-571-1228. Please say your name clearly and tell us where you're calling from. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, and Michael Jones. We had additional engineering this week from Michael Johnson, Claire Schoen, Sarah Fishman, and NPR New York. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the Grantham Foundation, for the protection of the environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.